everybody. Did I wake you up? You're in the Operations Management Integration and Security Working Group meeting. If you didn't mean to be here, the other working groups are next door. Oh, there's only one? Sorry. Yeah, there's only one this time today. Opt-in is that way, or that way. Actually, that way now that I'm standing in this direction. We're hoping to have a really interactive session here today. So even though it's early in the morning, please interrupt us at any time if you have questions or comments. We're actually going to try to brainstorm a few things. We do have a microphone in the middle, and we are recording this working group session. So usually more people end up listening to the working group than can attend in person. So it's important to use the mic when you ask questions or make comments, just so that other people who aren't here can understand it later on. There's a page on the wiki, which is what we're using here to show the agenda, and all the slides are uploaded there. And we'll also upload the minutes there later on as well. If you have any contribution to the minutes, you know, things that you observed in the meeting and would like to have be part of the minutes, please send them to Mike Patton. His email is going to be in his presentation. He'll be putting together the minutes for the combined presentations. And he's sitting down now instead of standing up because he's taking notes already. So do you want to just stand up quickly so people can see you? This is Mike Patton. He's the system engineer for the OMIS group. He's responsible for turning the things that we discuss here and the decisions that we make and the recommendations that he has from his own experience as a longtime internet engineer into guidelines, documentation, maps, things like that to help people with integration and operations and security on the Genie project. I'm gonna do a little agenda bashing. We don't have we don't have a lot of topics, but we have a fair amount of time allocated to each. So what we are proposing to do is to talk at the beginning, we have kind of two ideas of things we can brainstorm in the room. One is to talk about what the operations transition points are. So what are the things that are going to happen in Genie that are going to change the way we need to do things in operations and in the projects? So a simple example being when we actually start sharing data between the different clearinghouses and people want to access that data, that's going to change the way people interact with operations and the way we store things and the way we give people tools to access that information. There's a lot of other things like that, and we'd like input from you as to what you think they are. Another thing that we might discuss is we actually have as a working group deliverable a survey of what the existing technologies are for doing operations and management that people like or hate. And by technologies, I mean open source code, things you wrote yourself, things you can buy off the shelf, even simple things like tried and true procedures that you've used in your operations world. We took a first cut at this on the web and put up a page and asked people to respond, and probably nobody in this room except for me and the couple of people who are closely involved in operations have ever looked at it, but it was a miserable failure. We got like three people answering the poll, and one of them was me. So so we'd like to collect those things from you in some other way. And so I'd just like a show of hands in the room of whether you think it might be a more useful discussion to talk about transition points and how operations you see changing over the course of Genie, or operations tools that you love and hate. So raise your hand if you want to talk about transition points. Does anyone want to talk at all? And raise your hand if you want to talk about operations tools you love and hate. OK, transition points then. We can talk about the other one at the end during lightning talks if we don't have lightning talks or if they're really short. Lightning talks is a chance for anybody to stand up. You don't need slides. You just need to have something to share with the rest of the group. So if you're interested in doing a lightning talk, please do sneak up here to the front and let either Mike or me know so that we know whether we're using that time for that or not. Okay? With that said, I'm going to do 10 minutes, okay? All right, so I'm going to do 10 minutes on the transition points, and I do have a slide to help. To my what? Okay, so the question that's come up, and we've discussed it in one OMIS meeting that was a telephone meeting and a couple others in person, is what are the transition points that make us do things differently? I put a few on here, but really what we want to do is get more from you. And some of them we have an idea when they're going to happen, so I put in parentheses when they're going to happen. The first thing that needs to happen is that projects start using resources that aren't at their local site, right? Everybody's starting Genie with what they already had that they could bootstrap. A few people are actually starting from scratch, but mostly you start on your own little machine or in your own little test bed. But at some point you start combining, at least with the clearinghouse, if nothing else, and hopefully with other projects. So that's just starting now, actually. Some of the demos, for those of you who were here the first day, are doing things with their clearinghouses, and some of the projects like the Gush tools are being deployed in different infrastructures, so we're just starting to see that one. Another big one that's coming up that we kind of encourage to come up by putting things in people's milestones is when researchers who are outside the development teams join the Genie project and start using the infrastructure and the tools, and they weren't involved in writing them, so you have a different kind of way that you have to support those people. Feel free to stop me or comment or anything if you disagree. Network incidents, which I'm sure Steve will discuss in more detail. You know, there's always the period where you plan what you're going to do for a network incident, and maybe if you're lucky, write some procedures, and then they happen, right? So how you debug and respond to network incidents, particularly security incidents, has a big impact on operations. So this is going to happen in Spiral 1 for sure. As far as I know, it hasn't happened yet, but you know, maybe just nobody's told me. I didn't see anything during the demos, but so that's going to be a big one, and it's a hard one because you can't plan for everything that you have to do to respond to it. Data sharing I mentioned before, having opt-in users join experiments. There are a lot of issues just with having opt-in users at all, and that's what they're discussing in the next room. But from an operations point of view, it means that you don't necessarily know everyone that's in your user community. And there are questions about what do you need to tell those people? Do you need to tell them anything? What do you do to inform them of issues with the infrastructure or security issues? What do you do about their computers that are connecting into other Genie infrastructure and trying to maintain some kind of policy about how to, you know, keep them from infecting Genie. So, yeah?
I guess I don't know the difference between Spiral 1 and Spiral 2 in that respect.
We are recording for posterity. Yeah, just repeat it.
Okay, for posterity, what is the difference between Spiral 1 and Spiral 2? Does that mean that Spiral 1 is not intended to have uncontrolled access?
No.
Only friends come
so
in?
So Spiral 1, to some extent, is just a window in time, right? So Spiral 1 is going on right now, and most of the milestones end. You want to give it back? Or I just assumed you were going to have a comment after that. So in general, good.
This implied to me that Spiral 1 was friends only and Spiral 2 was somehow going to be open to the outside.
So,
I just wanted clarification.
Right. So it's not a rule at all, but being realistic about where people are and where they're going to be by September, right? Mostly it's going to be friends in Spiral 1. By the end of Spiral 1, there are actually a few projects who have as milestones to get external users. So it will happen if they meet their milestones.
So I know it says, so number one is, I think there's some variations in number one that might be worth calling out. If you had, and I don't know that we have this, but I think it's worth looking into, if you have an aggregate that has terms of use that are substantially different than what, say, people would assume or sort of, you know, what people, I don't know, something for the word special, right? Mm-hmm. Come up some definition mm-hmm. for that. Then, you know, we're going to need to sort of either change it or harmonize it or find a way to make sure that people understand it before they start using it.
Yep. That's a good point. The other thing that happens in Spiral 2 is mostly federation, too. So, you know, the clearinghouses operate together more. Everything gets more integrated.
But that's way future.
No, Spiral 2 is the next year. It starts October. And if it is, nobody told me.
Go ahead. I'm bad at definitions.
Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've heard different people trying to use Spiral 1 and Spiral 2 to refer to different things. And
so I may be using the terms wrong. If so, shame on me. But
right.
When I say Spiral 2, I mean that second year.
Right. In general, on this slide, if you replace Spiral with year, it may make more sense to people.
Not wrong.
Right.
Thanks, Aaron.
I've been at big meetings where I heard the same thing that James said. I've also been at large meetings where I've heard different definitions of what Spiral 1 and Spiral 2 are. And I usually try and avoid them, although
okay,
I do have that.
Okay, let's get more input.
So I'm not good at all these definitions, and I'm new to all this, so I can't use your language.
That's fine.
But it strikes me that there are some significant hard problems in here that have to do with the fact that at some point, and I don't know whether aggregate is the right word or federation is the right word, but as resources, sets of resources are being composed into Genie, they will have their own operations and management and so forth with their own private control.
Yes, absolutely.
Which they are not going to want to share wholesale with everybody
absolutely.
Else. So
yep.
There's a much more complicated, you know, you can assume right now maybe everybody's all in the bathtub together, but they're not.
No,
they won't
they're
be.
Not.
And that set of problems that have to do with the fact that you've got two different security domains with respect to management, I think it has to be,
yep.
you know, ought to be architected from the beginning. It's not like you say, okay, well, in Spiral 2 or Spiral 3, suddenly we're going to solve that problem
yes.
that we hadn't had before.
Yeah, I agree, and it is happening in Spiral 1 already,
okay. So
and we'd love to have people
So there's another point
that
I wanted to make, which I wanted to make when Dave was talking yesterday, when he yep. was talking about network management, and he talked about, and I think this is true in your examples, your case studies also, he was talking about situations where one needs to dig down and find the fault. A link has failed, a
yep.
node has failed,
yep.
a router has failed, something has failed.
Yep.
Some of the kinds of problems are not localizable.
Right.
A routing loop isn't in one place. You know, there are a number of examples of those kinds of things. One of the things we popped up at one of our students was, what if you end up in a situation where every link is losing a small percentage of traffic,
mm-hmm.
and as a result, you can't get a TCP connection because you don't get enough packets through.
Yep.
You never can complete the TCP connection. There is no one, every link is actually operating correctly,
mm-hmm.
but the composite isn't.
Yeah, right.
So there are kinds of problems that are not amenable to the sort of normal, oh, well, we'll just do fault isolation and root cause analysis and end up with the problem.
Yep, yeah, because we'll have several domains.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, even in the simplest projects that are happening in the first year, we have Internet 2 or NLR, a campus network.
They run themselves. You're right.
So they have a bit of coordination just to do what they already do to...
Well, not only coordination, but they've got, as Aaron was saying, there are different policies,
yeah,
but
policies and operations.
There are different security domains.
Yes.
And as a result, there may be different kinds of information that you can or can't get. If people are running experiments in their experimental network, they may have something go wrong, or in the underlying infrastructure, something may go wrong, and you need to figure out which one. You don't necessarily want your experimenters to have access to all of the
right.
underlying network
right.
management information, but they may need some, and you may need to know something about their experiments, but if they're doing security experiments, you may not be able to know a lot of what they're doing because it has to remain within that more constrained context.
Yep. Yep.
For example.
You'll find some interesting things when the GMOC people talk about that too. Okay, others? Okay, here's some that are just my opinion. I think things are gonna change a lot when we start having a lot of mobile handsets in Genie. Whatever those handsets happen to be, whether they're phones, whether they're computers, whether they're some kind of new unit that we haven't talked about. But there's a huge, going from a small controlled community to a really large community, that'll probably happen there if we're successful. I think storage clusters, which we don't really have yet, we have like one or two in CMU, but not everywhere, have a whole bunch of problems that are their own with what data do you keep, what data do you not keep, how do you give access out. International federation and legal action. Everybody who's here who's in operations knows that sooner or later you get served or someone asks you for information or any one of many things can happen, and that usually changes the way you do things. So input about what kinds of things you've had occur there. Aaron?
So I can think of two variants of storage clusters. One is the ability for anonymous storage in Genie, where you run into DMCA kinds of issues,
mm-hmm.
And the other is, and this might be a separate item, sort of the establishment of a Genie privacy policy, and because at that point I think or this may be establishment of a Genie anything policy. Since we've talked about several different kinds of policies, but you're going
right.
to see that's going to be a major transition once we expect everybody to sort of do common things. It's going to be something that will sort of entail a lot of work and
yeah.
maybe some disruption.
Yep.
This mic thing's going to stifle discussion big time, but at any rate, a lot of this is, and I never had anything to do with Planet Lab until we were using it for Genie. A lot of this stuff is very well trodden ground in Planet Lab, of course.
Yep. Yeah, we don't want to reinvent. You'll notice that when we discuss the recommended use policy. okay, so what I'd like to do is try and continue this discussion on the mailing list. So if you didn't speak up in the room, please respond on the mailing list. The input that we get from you guys really can make a huge difference. And if we don't have the discussions ahead of time, it's a very small group of people who I can sort of personally put the screws to and make them get these answers for me, but they're not going to be nearly as good answers as if we get, the 100 people that are on the OMIS list to actively participate. So please think about checking the OMIS list and sending a message off on this topic. Okay, next on the agenda. We have Steve giving a talk about security and the architecture. How many people went to the control framework meeting yesterday? Okay, so less than half, so I guess you may need to review a little bit. And I went a little bit long. Okay. Let's see, where did I put it? This already? Nope. Sorry, I should have opened it up ahead of time.
uh, put it.
Oh, sorry, duh. I'm not used to.
Okay, is that okay, Aaron? Hi, I'm Steve Schwab from Cobham. Formerly, we were Sparta, and many other names. Our research lab has been acquired by another company, and we're counting towards the next name change. But we'll be known from this point forward as Cobham Analytical Services. But the Sparta name will still be in use as well. Okay, so this talk is, in some sense, prompted by two things. One, there is a Gini security architecture draft. It mostly addresses mechanisms in the control frameworks, and I spoke about that yesterday. I'm not going to talk about that today except on one small intersecting point. And the thing is, I'd like people to read the Gini security architecture draft and provide feedback. I will talk about one particular section of that document, which is probably not really architecture, but is more the issues of what should perhaps deploying Gini projects have to worry about as they come to the end of this sort of initial rollout and start, quote, deploying in Spiral 1. So really, what should we be doing, or at least thinking about doing, as Gini projects become operational in some sense? And so, you know, we've got these control frameworks, we've got a lot of projects in the clusters. They operate things that are already test beds. We're going to relabel them component managers and aggregate managers and all their resources. But you know, how do we align this with this the Gini operational security concerns? And maybe there's a more fundamental question. What does it mean for something to be part of Gini? Because the reality is we've got this sea of stuff out there. It's already on the network. We're building it into evolving larger network structures. And so in some sense, just because my, you know, my piece of deter or you know, Rob's Emulab stuff or Larry's Planet Lab stuff becomes Gini, you know, compatible and plugs in with other things, it doesn't change its nature in some way. It's still very much the thing that it was before, except now maybe it interconnects with experiments that are, or hosts experimental slices that are stretched across a much larger set of resources. And this sort of transition is it's incremental, and then there's this phase change, right? So I was thinking about this. I'm one of the people who is too young to have been there when the internet rolled out. When I arrived at Berkeley, mid-83, internet already, you know, worked. And so I've always been places where the internet was already there and assumed to be in existence, and normally arrived just in time for it to work just well enough so, you know, we would use it and it would, you know, occasionally break. Still having an effect?
No, it's still happy net.
Oh, still happy net. sure, maybe it was still a happy net. Sure. Okay. So there wasn't just the masses on it. But in some sense, we're building this isolated thing a little bit, but it's not really isolated in any way like the ARPANET. Or the early internet was in some sense isolated to, you know, you and your closest, you know, 100 or 5,000 friends who knew how to do networking. Okay, so the security architecture document lists some major points, and I think there you know, there's explicit trust. What resources are granted or accessed to an individual through some trust authorization structure, and then basic, you know, least privilege, ability to revoke access to resources, and an auditability and accountability set of mechanisms. And these are all standard ideas that come through in most security literature. And we can build in the technical means into the systems to support doing this. And probably all five of the control frameworks will have various flavors of this in development as they stand things up. But the question really for us are how, at the next level, the operations level, layer 8, where we use these mechanisms, you know, are we going to do things? And what should folks be on the hook to do or thinking about doing? Because we're not really going to come down and say, you can't label yourself as Genie if you haven't gone through our 10-step process, right? They're going to stand up. They're going to be doing things. So this is a work-in-progress action items list. But let's just take a look at some of these things. So roots of trust. Everybody has some sort of certificate or root certificate in their system. I think at this point, 4 of the 5 frameworks will have some sort of root certificate. And they've generated one, and it's normally a self-signed certificate they've got lying around on their machine, exposed to the first guy who roots their machine and takes that certificate. So there is a large body of work. Dan Bonet has some nice systems for how to do certificate sharing and for high-value e-commerce, and there's other places. But perhaps we should take the simplest thing. Let's just have a super root certificate that we don't use. We just sign an extra layer and stash it away in a drawer someplace. And those private keys are just protected by not being online. And that'll give us a way to revoke the true root key that we're using. Go ahead.
Can we actually ask of the people in the room who uses certificates that aren't self-signed for their test beds and infrastructure?
I don't know if we have too many of the, we don't have Larry here, we don't have Rob here.
Oh, not for the control framework, just in
general? Oh, in general.
In whatever you do, whether it's Genie or not.
How many people pay for certificates that have, you know, VeriSign or Thought or somebody's signatures on them?
I just said we have a mix of both. We have some self-signed, some real, depending sort of on the exposure of the thing that we're protecting.
Can you say where you're from?
Yeah, Luke Feller, Global Knock, Indiana University.
So nobody else?
I just wanted to say that all our infrastructure that we expose, the university imposes a whole set of minimum security standards that we have to follow. So in some sense, we have a lot of things in place that we can leverage. I mean, we are already doing, and we'll do for Genie too.
Say which project you are.
So the Kansai project, we are under the ORCA control framework from Ohio State University.
This is Chris Tracy from Max. We use wildcard certs for websites, wikis, you know, anything that's kind of web oriented. Everything else is all self-signed though.
Nobody else? Karen Sullins, who's...
So MIT does, but I don't know where, and I, you know, Jeff Schiller is so far across campus, I don't see him.
Actually, in Greek community, Greek computing, we use certificates a lot. So for each CA, each site has some CA, and issue some certificates that you can log into the grid system like TerraGrid and other grid systems.
So who is the signer on those certificates?
Typically centralized.
Okay, so to the
It's just like for global certificate, it's signed by Chicago Argonne National Lab.
Just one other comment. I forgot to mention, we actually kind of have, we don't self-sign all our certificates. We actually have kind of a ad hoc group of root CAs that we kind of, you know, agree on mutual trust between maybe 4 or 5 of these. So each of these CAs can sign certificates for users or other people downstream. We all trust each other, though. So
are all those certificate authorities in some sense at the same campus, or are they?
No, not at all. No, in fact, they're spread around the globe, actually.
Okay.
So I actually have no idea, because the answer is whatever the university does, and it's going to be different depending on whether it's the department or the research institute or the university-wide. And I first started noticing it, which will be an issue for us as web browsers and email clients start getting anal and warning people that danger, danger, if you have a self-signed certificate. So that may be something we want to think about as well, because now we have an extra interface to protect users that might give them information that's more protective than we need.
Anybody else? Okay.
Okay, so, you know, so the, unfortunately, right out of the gate, the answer is There is no uniform way it's done, of course. Compliance varies from, well, I set up this machine, and it's whatever the grad student did when they set up those certificates, to a fairly centralized CIO-based system that looks not too unlike what you'd see in some of the better corporate or government operations, which actually do try to sign certificates and roll things out. They'll have a word on that. And so basic bottom line is there's going to be some root certificates, and then there's going to be all the other ones that are signed. And I'm pretty much not too worried about any other certificate that's signed by something else, because as long as you have a revocation mechanism of some sort, we'll be able to revoke the certificate if something is lost. So there's a hook there. It's just the root certificates could be right now in the beginning, they're in few places, they're not widely distributed. It's easy to think about, do we have a mechanism for replacing them if we have to? If we don't have a mechanism for replacing them, are they protected in a way that we're not going to get them compromised? And the root certificate sitting with its private keys on the machine that is the experimental version of your software that's running on this network, that's the one place it probably shouldn't be on day one, and that's probably where it is. So then there's this other thing. Rob Rieke from the Protogenie Emulab project pointed out they're not yet doing hierarchies of certificates. I mean, their current prototype, I mean, they plan to do it, but their current prototype is just a flat structure. They're just signing one level deep. So they can't actually sign a chain of these things and stash one in the desk drawer or use their campus root certificate. So they've got to have some other way in place for planning on root certificate rollover. And in that case, it may be just a good idea for them just to plan to do it at 12 months or something, just to test that they can do it before they discover they have more sites than they can handle. 4 sites or 8 sites or something, it's easy to roll over. It's that exponential growth on the curve. So we'll see how this works out. Now, interestingly enough, many years ago when we were part of McAfee and had the PGP brand in-house, there was a big initiative to roll out signed PGP keys in what was then Network Associates. So maybe 3,000 or 4,000 employees worldwide. So the interesting thing about that exercise was we got to see what people who actually understood the technology and key management were going to do to roll out essentially a public key infrastructure with signing keys in a corporate hierarchy. So there were about 6 levels of keys that nobody but the key signing guys really understood about special signing keys and revocation keys and operational keys in the hierarchy in different regions of the world. But the key signing structure was very complicated, much, much different than what you see in ad hoc environments. And then the second thing was the cost per key. I mean, we didn't know, but estimate between $1 and $500 just to get a signed key in this hierarchy because of the huge overhead in administrative cost to really set one of these things up. So it's clear that if you want to maintain any kind of PKI with signing and really tight controls on what's been signed, you're paying a huge administrative cost. If we just want to allow the world to sign keys and there's certificates that are used in chains, and we don't really know who signed what, it's sort of the PGP web of trust model, then the cost is very low because people locally do things. And so we have this trade-off, and we've got to recognize we do not want to be in the business of costing $100 to $500 to get a signed key into the hands of users. And this is the same thing. We could go to VeriSign or one of the providers and do this, but they're going to charge us significant step functions. That will get us an answer, I think. Oh, Aaron stepped out. Well, it'll get us an answer to one of Aaron's questions, which is, how do we know who people really are? Well, that's we've paid money to somebody to vet individuals, but too expensive, I think, for our world, and probably not the right fit. Okay. Points of contacts and operational information. We're going to set up these systems. They're going to be on the network. They're going to be operating with other Genie projects. Things are going to grow and interconnect. Do we actually have an idea of who the sysadmins are and who the super users are on those boxes? And when they change, which is going to happen every 6 months, every year or so, as different people roll through the labs, is anybody bothering to update the information? So it's not so much getting the information on day one, but having the plan that somebody gets super user access, they're now a sysadmin. Somebody's being told outside the local group. There's some sort of process in place. And of course, super users shouldn't be running all the time as super user. We know that, but in the Genie context, you're sort of, you're red dot on your Emulab, or you have a certificate that lets you do everything to debug the system. There's a real tendency for that to become the way to get things done. This is bad on two levels. One, you've got these powerful keys or certificates being used all the time, but also we don't really debug what the ordinary users need to get their work done, because we're always helping them out by, we'll just, you know, look at everything with global permissions. And then one other thing we should probably do, physical and configuration audits, just where are the machines that matter to security? We don't need to know where every machine is, but the control nodes, whether it's component managers, aggregate managers, the slice and management authorities, the boxes that are relevant to security, we should know where those are. Now, I'm sure the local campuses all have track, you know, keep track of that information there in the lab that's locked. The question is how far up or across the Federation of Genie participants does that information need to be shared? And this is kind of a judgment call, but where do you go to shut down or, you know, do a revocation or find out what's wrong? Okay, other things on the actions item list, source code reviews. Okay, so it turns out that in industry, especially in defense contractor industry, you know, source code reviews are painful, long, formal processes. We do all kinds of things. Not really necessary here, but research code often has just trivial bugs in the security machinery that would basically be discovered if somebody said, give a talk on the security stuff in your implementation and just tell it to, you know, two other people. Maybe one of which at least has built a system like that before. We'd be happy to listen to that kind of talk. We're really good at asking dumb questions that are like, well, did you actually, you know, do you reject the request if the security crypto check fails, or do you just, you know, fall through? It turns out, I was talking to one of the researchers here who looked at this for, Red Hat or Fedora updates, you know, describing papers that, you know, there's all this machinery for checking, you know, RPMs or whatever, and things aren't done right in terms of validating the checksums. And so there's a lot of security relevant code that a review will just catch the first order of problems. And we should probably do that. At least it will save us from discovering later that somebody out in the network has helped find our bugs for us. And you know, this is low hanging fruit. Emergency shutdown procedures. So we don't expect to do any emergency shutdowns, right? We expect all our experiments will run, and when people notice them going wrong, they'll shut them down themselves, because nobody will go home and leave, you know, the equivalent of ping running overnight. And ping might, in fact, be, well, you know, ping at high data rate that was filling up a 10 gig pipe that got, you know, put out, you know, routed onto a backbone when something failed. But the expectation is local clusters or the folks who are closest to those boxes will run things, but there's this whole question of how could we shut things down? Who would be identified as the person to contact if you needed to do a shutdown? We should have that identified in the beginning. This is a small set of people. It's easy as things scale up, and the potential for experiments to get distributed widely changes. You know, there'll be a point where you can't just call or email the small set of people to shut things down, and so I think this happened on Planet Lab at some point, where there were, you know, a few incidents where Planet Lab things do touch the internet, Genie things will touch the internet. It's a matter of time till we have our first incident, and it probably will be the case that the Genie folks won't know about it, because it's going to come from campus X, machine Y, and so the question is, you know, who there will know about it. I've got a pointer to the current draft on the wiki. Please take a look. Let's see. User and site management. Okay, so there was Aaron's question from the end of the talk yesterday. How are we documenting the identities and credentials assigned to new users? And are we at least keeping a list of those users so we know who we actually have assigned to in some local cluster? Because the reality is that by granting access in a local cluster, it'll only be a matter of time before you're granting access indirectly through the transitive trust to run on Genie nodes that have no idea who that person is. All they know is, I mean, because they'll have some policy in place that will let them share resources. So we've got Federation machinery already working in the Tide cluster. The Proto-Genie guys essentially have it working. We're not very far away from it, I think, in the Planet Lab universe. And so it'll pretty quickly become normal that somebody will be using resources, you know, day in and day out, from some where they were signed up at some remote place. And it's a small number of remote places initially, but once you get to 10 or 20 remote places, that's big enough to have this question of who's using what and why are there no free nodes? I've got a demo for my program manager. I need to get all these nodes. Why can't we get these guys off? So then we just kick them off, and then somebody's complaining because now things have failed. So there is this problem. And then one of the more difficult things maybe is not the, you know, there's everyone will monitor their local infrastructure. There's probably somebody actively working the project as a researcher who is going to be on it all the time, debugging it, adding new features. So there'll be somebody in the beginning always monitoring their local piece. How that coordinates with the campus network that they're transitioning will be interesting. When we put the first deter clusters at Berkeley and ISI, there were points at which the, you know, we had a tunnel, like maybe a gigabit tunnel across some part of the Berkeley backbone. And if you ran any DDoS traffic across that tunnel, even though they had the campus folks had set up this gigabit, you know, tunnel for us, if we actually used it, they were like mad. We were using their, you're sending a gigabit across this, we're shutting it down. Well, but that's our tunnel. We use it as part of the experimental infrastructure. So there's got to be some coordination to let folks know that people will actually use the bandwidth that they're setting up. We're not just setting up pipes, whatever sorts of forwarding paths across the campus infrastructure with no intention of actually using it. The folks, I believe running Genie Slices will stress things and will start to scale things up, and they're experimenters, so they're gonna do things that are either unknowingly using much more traffic than they expected or intentionally pushing the traffic across the network, and that is gonna set off concerns among folks who are used to, you know, 10% utilization, and we're probably not going to be 10% utilization kind of customers. Okay, and then one more slide to set to roll into Heidi's talk on the resource usage policy. I'm not going to talk about the resource usage policy, but stepping back, you know, are we setting the right usage policy out of the gate? Do we have a good sense of what should be the trade-off between, you know, what you should be allowed to do versus, you know, our desire maybe to have tight controls on what people should do. And this is the difference between different test beds in terms of who can do what and how much we ask about what you're going to do before, you know, giving you the keys to the car matters. Researchers often say, I'm studying topic X, and topic X is a pretty broad and fuzzy thing in the beginning, and all they want to say is, well, I want to run some experiments. And they perhaps haven't even written down more than beyond that broad category. That's what they're going to do. And no idea how much traffic, oftentimes only limited knowledge that they're going to do any security-relevant attacks or anything that we might consider problematic from a security point of view. And it's natural because they haven't worked out their research plans. So how do we pull people in to use Genie, make it, in some sense, warm and fuzzy? We want you to come and use the system. And at the same time, not have a sign here on this scary thing saying you're not going to do any of these bad things. And oh, by the way, we're going to check and ask for a lot of questions. And you can't get a lot of information up front. So you have to, you know, work out how the community will make that conversation happen so that as people do mature their experiments and continue to use the facility, they provide more information. So the other thing is, you know, should we be adjusting what we consider to be the risk of the experiments going on with Genie over time? And this is sort of the, we have a natural reaction. How bad is any of these things that are potentially going to happen as we load code onto some boxes? Because after all, we build network things. The Genie platforms are not fundamentally different on day one from the test beds that they started originating from. And so the risk is no more worse than what I was doing yesterday. It's now maybe part of a Genie framework and can connect to two or more sites, but nothing's really changed right out of the gate. So why do I need to do anything more than what I did before? I mean, that'll be the natural reaction of researchers. And over time, we've got to sort of have a sense of what's going on globally across all the experiments on the facility, how widespread has the facility become as its footprint on the internet. And so, you know, at what point do we actually have to start watching more closely? There's a sort of risk management process here that's a little different than just saying, well, one experiment should do one thing. It's a set of experiments on the set of all resources. You know, at what point do we become a problem for the internet versus, you know, so certainly not on day one. On day one, we're no worse, the internet's no worse off than it was the day before when people were using their own test beds and they weren't interconnected. All the same things could happen and the network did not break, mostly. So. And then, you know, and then, so there's the sanity checks. Are we underestimating or overestimating risk? Many of us will say, oh, there's very little risk. We're far overestimating. But then we don't consider the fact that the research code running in slices is itself vulnerable to attack from clever hackers who would just like more botnets, and the nodes that are, you know, connected in are suffering from all the endemic attacks. You know, have we increased or decreased the vulnerability of systems on campuses, on the backbone? You know, and so we've got to, you know, worry about what's going on at the site of the campus, at the internet, and overall to the Genie project, because we're, you know, we're sort of, we can be tainted as, oh, those Genie guys, they, you know, they run, you know, so-and-so's network over there, and, you know, they crashed the backbone of that campus. We don't want those guys around, versus a perception that the Genie project is a little bit ahead of the curve on the security and operations side. And so basically they build up some goodwill, which says, well, the Genie guys know what they're doing, so we can pretty much let them have the resources and do what they want. You know, there's a certain degree of buy-in that you have to earn when you get started. So should we be a little bit conservative or a little bit like Wild West? And then, you know, there's a trade-off there. That's all I had. I'm not sure there's any questions or comments. Wasn't controversial enough? I was going to tell everybody we should just operate it as a classified network and give everybody security clearances, but.
So everyone's okay with doing security audits of all your code?
I said very lightweight audits.
That's going to at least be controversial.
I wasn't going to answer that, but I was going to suggest that one of the things that is critically important for all of network management, and this is, goes doubly for all the security set of issues, is that the objective of all of this is to let packets through and to make the make traffic work. And the more other things we do in the whole management regime, whether it's sloshing in logs of stuff around or, you know, trying to, you know, all the different kinds of things we do in network management, those do take resources away from our users unless we had a second net that was actually the net for network management, which is probably not something that's going to happen, and, you know, it's unlikely to work that way or be built that way. So I think one of the things that is critical for all of us to remember is the final objective is not what we're doing. The final objective is what all of them are doing. And to the extent we're doing things that cause them problems, use up their resources in various ways, we're not doing our job as well as we could be. I mean, I think there's this dilemma. It's not that there's a right answer, because if you have no security and no management, they're not going to get good service either.
And let me make a comment. So I agree with that. And I'll point out that probably the scarcest resource is the human labor time to actually
Absolutely.
Set up and run and debug the system.
Which is why I talk about the knowledge plane, because
So the problem here is that mostly, you know, security gets turned off. You know, I mean, how many of us turn off NFS, you know, checks of any kind so we can access NFS file systems on any of our private networks? Because invariably the security checks, you know, cause headaches, and it's just, I just want to get to that file system. Yeah. And I think there's a tendency that we, you know, the security actually has to work sort of in an invisible way
Invisible means both to the people and to the whole operation of the thing as much as possible. I agree.
So most security tools out there today assume well-defined organizational boundaries. They work inside firewalls, inside certain administrative domains. And now with Genie, we have things crossing over organizational boundaries. We have experiments that grow across organizational boundaries. So I assume there'll be a lot more work that needs to be done in terms of tools to detect security events and to manage security. And that's something,
Well, let's see. If we don't have any tools to detect them, then we can claim there are no security incidents, and then we don't have to report them or manage them. I think there may be some degree of that, though in the sense that these are experimental slices, and there's perhaps less day-to-day data and operational use. I mean, you're not getting your email, you're not accessing the web, there's not a web server necessarily hosting things right out of the gate. My sense is the tools we have that folks use already are the tools that will continue to be used. And so I don't know if we're going to end up having to build technical features in to help us span those organizational domains, because my guess is they wouldn't really work. Right off, I think we're going to have the same tool sets being used locally, and we're going to have to, at a higher level, push data or, you know, person-to-person communication across. Now, things which let us have experiment slices that look uniform inside the slice and do the right isolation will be great, because then whatever tools somebody chooses to use inside that slice, should be adequate. I'm hoping that we don't have this problem. It's more the infrastructure really is, these are pieces of test beds that are scattered about. So I think it's an interesting question whether we're going to actually see a need for some different kinds of tools. That being said, the tools used on the internet today for crossing, BGP across autonomous systems, that requires phone calls too. There's not that great coordination for security events, in the internet today. So I'm not sure we're going to see, and partly that's not just tools, that's sharing of data. So if we do things right, perhaps we can share some of the data to avoid that problem in from growing up in Genie again.
So I guess I don't know if this is anything new or not, but we are going to go. HappyNet was the thing that was proposed after undergraduates started coming on the network big time in about 92, 93. September got longer every year. We'd say in Usenet, it's November and it's still September. And then when in 94 with privatization, when everybody came in, somebody proposed HappyNet as this, going back to the good old days. And we're going to start out as HappyNet with just people we know on wanting to do things. But we're going to get to the point when presumably we're told to open up to everybody, where everybody in the world is going to be trying to hack in. So there's going to be this balance of what to do when in security.
Yeah, so I guess an interesting question, are we really going to start off in the happy net, state? In some sense, there is this internet, and it's very hard to tell how many touch points we're going to have. Right out of the gate. So
assuming you're secured so that you're walled off, which are, we've got all our services closed down and we've got IP tables running all the machines. So assuming that we're reasonably secure and then only letting people we know inside of that, that's sort of what I mean. So initially we're only going to let people on Japini, which is us that we know. But at some point, I think 6 months from now, we have agreed to open to limited external experimentation, whatever that means.
Yeah, but those will still be external experimentation in the Genie community sense, right? So that's still, somebody, through one indirect hop. It's when we say, well, there's now long running educational or commercial services in the infrastructure that things change.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, that's related back to the previous discussion we were having on Heidi's slides, which is those are some transition points where we get users in a new class. You start off, all the users are the people in the neighboring offices because you're building this little test bed and it's not really connected, and then it's the people you've met at the Genie conference, it's still only a couple hundred people, and then suddenly it's opt-in and anybody on the internet can sign up and use your resource, and that's a different transition and a different model of how you operate it. And security is one of the things that goes into those transitions, is suddenly you have a different security exposure when you have some of those transition points.
Yeah, I mean, some of us have probably been thinking a little bit about the opt-in users and the things like, well, we have a DHT for storing and software updates, and somebody decides to come along and say, well, the software updates I'm going to do is the My Movie database, and we've got enough bandwidth to move 5 gig movies around, and then all the kids on the college campuses decide to download the movies. We could go pretty quickly from a service which is purely experimental to one which is very usable, especially with early adopters, and then suddenly have people knocking on our door. So, that period that was more than a decade in internet time may turn out to be just a couple years or less in Genie time.
Have you looked at the explicit certificate used by the Zigbee?
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
Have you looked at the explicit certificate used by the Zigbee Alliance coming with the
No.
new certificates, No.
I haven't looked at that. So is there something in particular, some feature that is particularly?
Well, actually, the user generates the private key. The private key doesn't come with the certificate. That's more secure, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's Aaron, so now we have to continue the conversation from yesterday.
Yes, but there's different people in the room, so maybe it'll, and John's not in the room, for example, so maybe it'll go a little bit differently. I'm not in the room, right? So I think that, and I was just actually chatting with Larry about this exact topic, that part of what's there's a question here that sort of underlies a lot of this, which is, you know, what is the need for policy in the first place? You know, if you take a completely distributed, everybody brings the stuff that they own and are responsible for, then I think the motivation for policy is how much assurance do they need that other people are going to behave or things will be used responsibly, or sort of a comfort level that will allow them to bring their stuff to the table. And so I think a development of a Gini policy there would be a useful thing because it will help set everybody's expectations on what's going on. Whether the policy is, what's the word for it, you know, whether it's a controlling policy, it is a requirement as opposed to sort of a guideline, I think is a question there. Then there's sort of another world where you have, and this is sort of going to the if you have a sponsor who is paying for a large piece of Gini, whoever that sponsor is, they might want to set the terms on how it's used. In which case, the policy is actually much more fundamental, especially if those pieces are required for the operation of Gini, as opposed to something you might choose or not choose to use. So I think that it's probably at this point useful to consider, you know, sort of both ends of that spectrum. So that we can sort of see where the commonality is, you know, focus on that, and then you know, make a decision as to, you know, later on we'll have a better idea of, you know, sort of where Gini is falling in that. But I think that without sort of understanding sort of where is this policy coming from, and who is it going to be inflicted upon, and why, it's kind of hard to sort of have this discussion on what the details should be.
I would agree. And maybe another point here is that a lot of this is not technical, you know, a lot of these things are not technical mechanisms at the end of the day. They're deciding on, you know, who thinks what and who will be agreeable to certain things.
Right. So a point that I'm not sure that everybody in this room, one of the things that I was surprised since I got involved with Gini is there's sort of a mind shift from, researchers are used to sort of owning and determining how the stuff that they control is used. And even in a Gini environment, when you are now using a significant resources from campus infrastructure, there's now this other party who you have to deal with and who is employed by the same people as you, you know, your IT department or your CIO, who has a different set of concerns. And I think in different institutions, they may or may not be very cooperative or willing to take risks. And I think that this is sort of an area that is, to me, not yet well understood on, you know, what are their sensitivities and what does it take to give them some assurance? You know, how comfortable is the IT department with having researchers that they don't know using stuff that's on their campus?
Yeah. How comfortable are they having researchers they do know use this stuff?
Right. Well, it will be equal to or less than the other. So, anyways.
So this is kind of just a follow-up on that. I think there are two categories of people or kinds of activity. I mean, the real problem is figuring out what people's intentions are or objectives are. And one class of those people are people who want to make money, who are out there to set up a business. And all of a sudden, there's, you know, a free cloud out there in some sense that they can go use. They don't have to pay Amazon anymore because there are a whole lot of resources that they might be able to use here if they've gotten the access. And the other is people with malicious intent who are likely to forge identities and then start collecting resources and doing all the things that they do that we have grown to love and hate. And I think both of those are real problems. The other related problem to that is that some of the resources, if they are funded by the government, are often funded for the purpose of doing research for the nonprofit academic universe in some sense. So even to the extent that we have people from industrial research labs trying to use this facility, there may be real issues with policy of who can do what with resources that were paid for by the government. Because I don't know what happens in other countries, but my guess is there are similar but different set of issues related to all those kinds of policies. And I think actually policy is something that has to be thought about well beyond whatever the small, nice, friendly community is now that might be using this, because if we don't put that stuff in place beforehand, it's probably too late.
Yeah, or at least having the rules of the game, the boundaries delineated.
We need to have all these discussions about who can do what with what kinds of resources, sort of exploring with people who may be contributing resources, what are their policies, so that we can start thinking about how do we integrate those policies in with the whole larger story. I mean, it's not that we can go in and dictate. You can't tell the CIOs or the university infrastructure people how their resources are going to be used. You can only ask, and they can say no. So we better figure out when they're going to say no. And I think you're right. I mean, I'm preaching to the converted with talking to you. I don't think that's a problem, but yeah, everybody.
Okay.
So just quickly following up on Karen's point, I think that's a transition point. Is commercial use of Genie. Maybe it comes, I don't know if it comes before or after legal action, but it's right around there.
Well, so when you say commercial, I mean, there's two kinds. I can imagine the technically, researchers in a lab, pick your favorite, corporate lab, who might be donating resources as well, might also want to use Genie. So that's a research use by a commercial organization, but that may not be directly what somebody would consider as commercial product or commercial service.
So that's a third. I was thinking of actually two others. One is where somebody's actually paying to use Genie, and the other is somebody's using Genie for a non-research purpose. And then you presented a third. So
I could run a phone company over Genie because, the bandwidth is cheaper to some country, so I could, I could offer phone service.
Yeah, where could is a technical statement.
So I was going to swap back into Aaron's original thing, but we kind of got back into it somehow. This is going to, from our perspective, we've got research fiber all the way out, and yes, we've got our university IT folk, buying on and blessing our hookups, but we really are then in control of all of our machines. But that's going to depend on the university. Where it's going to change, and maybe, I don't know if this is one of those transition points or another one, somebody was at CHIP, was talking about getting all these universities together and trying to get them to say, yeah, we're going to run it everywhere into the dorms and the university. That becomes a very different deal than us running our Genie nodes, even if outside people have access. So I don't know if that's another transition point or not.
But James, did you understand my point about yes, you own your machines, but users who are somehow let into Genie somewhere else are going to be running processes on them, and so maybe they're running a botnet on there. And how would your IT department feel about that?
Yeah, but that's like Final Lab.
Princeton's legal department? I mean, Princeton is not any university would tolerate those problems.
Although I imagine most that are running Planet Lab now have already. I mean, we've already had that happen a number of times. So at least in that sense, some of those things were already conditioned to.
Which makes an interesting point, which may be we're running we may want to piggyback on a part of a Genie substrate like Planet Lab that maybe already has buy-in in some sense as a known thing at some universities.
So that actually is a very good thing because I'm hoping to expand significantly, and all of my proposed new partners, many of them international, were worried about such things. And I said, oh, it's just like Planet Lab. And they say, oh, okay, I understand that. They're outside the firewall. University people know they're separate things. There may be some, that helped a lot.
Of course, you probably just told a big, little lie because, I'm the guy who came into, one of the early Planet Lab meetings and say, well, what I want to do is monitor the traffic this way because I want to look for new virus signatures or new viruses that I might want to have no signatures for or whatever. And the point was, of course, we weren't monitoring any traffic in a Planet Lab environment. right? There's no, you know, but we're gonna have this opt-in, there's this threshold where there's opt-in traffic where you start using Genie as your preferred web cache or whatever, because there's a cool service that does something better or whatever. And at that point, things change. As long as it's just researchers sending their traffic around, probing things across the network, testing their protocols, I think we're probably just like Planet Lab. Yeah, yeah, but opt-in when they start actually using the service that's provided in some slice for something that they don't care. They're not researchers at all, and they don't even really care that it's Genie. They're just using it because it's cool or different or, you know.
So coming back to this interaction with CIOs and so on, you know, there's a set of best practices around operations management and service management and so on known as ITIL. I don't know if folks have heard of it. Maybe the industry folks have. But for as you know, with respect to a framework we can use to sort of categorize what we're going to do, and you know, set up some policies and so on, that's a useful framework to look at.
In the sense, there might be buy-in.
Exactly. Firstly, and secondly, it's a nice categorization. I mean, you know, it's 8 volumes, so you don't want to go that route. But at least to use as a sort of a categorization of the things we need to do, and also to get the vocabulary to talk to the CIOs with, that's a useful thing.
Yeah. No, I'm concerned about the using up the scarce researcher time, you know. But nevertheless, if we can dress it up in a way that is, you know, the scaled down version of something that's familiar, that may be a good thing. Maybe a good detail to try to hone in on.